MacCast, Sunday, May 31st, 2015. This episode of the MacCast is brought to you by lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And by Casper. Casper is an online retailer offering obsessively engineered mattresses at shockingly fair prices. Get $50 towards any Casper mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/MacCast and using the code MACCAST. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. We've got a big show lined up for you today. Lots of things going on, lots of stuff to talk about. Of course, WWDC is right around the corner, so that means there's all kinds of rumors and happenings about what is going to be going on up there in San Francisco in just, about a week or so, a little more than a week at this point. We do have a couple new things to talk about. There are new 15-inch MacBook Pros and an updated iMac configuration that we haven't touched on yet. The Apple Watch update and SDK coming ahead of WWDC. More information on Apple's live streaming service. We're going to talk a little bit about iOS 9 and some of the features in there, specifically something I'm excited about, which is some of the HomeKit stuff. We'll be touching on that, and also Transit Maps may be coming to Apple Maps finally. And finally, Johnny Ive has a new title. We'll talk about all of that and, of course, get to your feedback and your comments. Got an update on Discovery D, an issue one of you is having with some color shifting after upgrading to Apple's new Photos application. We're going to touch on the Unicode bug that could be crashing your iOS devices. And also talk about one of your experiences recently with AppleCare. That and a bunch more stuff, of course, in just a minute. But before we get going, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is lynda.com. You know, lynda.com is for problem solvers. It's for curious people who want to make things happen. If you want to master Excel or maybe learn a new negotiation tactic, trying to get ahead in your job, maybe build a website, or maybe you just want to boost your Photoshop skills, you can go to lynda.com and feed your curious mind. Some of the courses that I would recommend you check out, they have this new playlist center, which is a bunch of curated playlists from the lynda.com experts. And I was poking around in there, and there's some great courses in there you probably should check out. Designing a logo. So if you've started up a company, maybe you're doing your own thing and you need a logo, you might take a look at that series of courses. Also, there's a whole series on project management software, using project management software, and one that I'm checking out right now, presentation skills. I have to give presentations to user groups. I've done them for different conferences and things like that, and I always want to brush up and get better at that sort of thing. And actually, to that end, I just discovered a course called Business Storytelling with C.C. Chapman. And I've known C.C. Chapman for a long time. He was one of the guys that was around in the early days of podcasting. Great business consultant. And, you know, I love podcasts, as you know. So storytelling is a great way to deliver content. I really love a bunch of storytelling podcasts, specifically the ones that NPR puts out. And I'm always striving to kind of reach that level of presentation. And so this course is something that I've thrown into my queue. I'm taking a look at. It's somewhat more business focused, but really it's providing me the outlines and techniques, I think, to become a better storyteller. And I think that can help out a lot with my podcasting. So that's the kind of content you can find on lynda.com. One of the reasons I really love it. And with a lynda.com membership, you can watch and learn from top industry experts who are really passionate about teaching. I love the quality of their instructors. You can stream thousands of video courses on demand, and you really get to learn at your own schedule. They're broken up into little chunks. You can come back to them, you can pause, or you can just go through them all at once. It's really up to you. And you can even browse the course transcript and follow along. And they now have this feature where you can actually click on different parts of the transcript to jump right to that part of the video. So again, if you need to come back, look at something, review something. They make it super, super easy. You can download notes. You can get tutorials and instructions with some of the programs. You can also get access on your iOS devices, your Android devices. So if you're on the go, you don't have to worry about that. And you can save off playlists to come back and watch things later. So I'm constantly finding new things on lynda.com, throwing those into a playlist, and I can come back. And best thing of all is that you can get access right now free for 10 days. You just go to lynda.com/Maccast. That's lynda.com/MACCAST. And you can get unlimited access to all of their training and really check it out. So I want you to try it out. Visit lynda.com/Maccast today to sign up. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the Maccast. Let's talk about some new Macs that came out. A couple weeks ago, we did our special episode with Victor Cajiao, our Amigos show, last time. So we didn't get a chance to talk about the new 15-inch MacBook Pro or the updates to the iMac. I don't necessarily need a new 15-inch MacBook Pro. Mine's, my 2011 model is humming along okay. I've had some issues, as you know, if you've listened to the MacCast. Dealt with those. Seems to be working really well right now, but this latest update to the 15-inch MacBook Pro has got me salivating. I really like what they've done with this. They've updated it with faster Intel processors. It has the new Force Touch trackpad technology that you would find in the 13-inch. Of course, it's got the Retina display, which I don't have on mine. Faster flash storage, up to 2.5 times faster, up to 2 gigabits per second on the flash. And I've seen some people who have received these and run them through the benchmarks. It is living up to the promise. So they are smoking fast on the flash storage. The new processors start at 2.2 gigahertz. It's an Intel Core i7 chip. Prices starting at $1,999 US, and you can also go for the higher level option. It's upgradable to a 2.5 gigahertz processor along with a dedicated AMD Radeon R9 M370X graphics processor. That starts at $2,499 US, and something that came out not long after this machine hit the market was that the AMD processor in there, if you do get the one with the dedicated graphics card, it is capable of driving Dell's dual cable 27-inch 5K display. So if you want to have an external 5K display to hook up to your MacBook Pro, this would be the model for you. Now, something on the processors to note, that these are not the new Broadwell processors from Intel that we've been hearing about. Those actually aren't shipping yet in quad-core configurations. So these are just upgraded faster Haswell processors, but still smoking fast and some good deals. So if you're in the market to upgrade your 15-inch MacBook Pro, you might take a look at Apple's new offerings. Apple also added a new entry-level model to their 5K iMac lineup, along with dropping the price on the top-end model a couple hundred bucks. The new version of the iMac has a 3.3 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5 processor, AMD Radeon R9 M290 graphics, along with 8 gigabytes of RAM standard, and a 1 terabyte hard drive, although it is not a Fusion drive like in the top-end model. The top-end model has a 3.5 gigahertz quad-core processor, Intel Core i5, AMD Radeon R9 M290X graphics, 8 gigabytes of RAM, and a 1 terabyte Fusion hard drive. That comes in priced at $2,299, which is now $200 lower than before. And if you're more interested in the entry-level configuration, that new price point is now $1,999 US. So a little bit lower entry-level price point on the 27-inch 5K Retina iMac. So if you've been waiting for those prices to come down, now would be the time to pick up one of those. Now, I will warn you, though, pricing has not come down for everyone. Prices are down in the U.S., but depending upon what country you're in, prices may have gone up just slightly, and that is because Apple has adjusted prices in Germany, France, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Portugal, Finland, and a few other countries in the European Union for the strong dollar. This is something that Apple will actually do from time to time, although it does upset many of their international customers. It is a historically just usual part of their business practice. So they're just adjusting for those rates, and so if you happen to be in one of those countries, the new 5K IMAX, for example, will actually have had a price increase from between 150 to 300 euros in various configurations. And another example is if you're looking at the Mac Pro, those configurations have increased from between 400 to 600 euros. So don't be shocked if you go in after hearing this report and find that those iMacs are costing you a little bit more if you happen to live in one of those regions. The Apple Watch has been out for a little while now, and while Apple still seems to be struggling to get units out and onto customers' wrists, with WWDC looming, we're starting to hear reports of what we might see in future Apple Watch updates. We're also hearing a little bit about the software development kit that's expected to be announced at WWDC so that developers can start building native third-party watch apps. Some of the things that we're hearing about, some features that I'm particularly interested in are things like Find My Watch for Apple Watch, which, as the name implies, would allow you to be able to press a button on your iPhone and then be able to remotely locate your watch. I'm assuming it would send a little ping signal out into your environment so that you could, you know, sort of track that down. We're also hearing that it would have the ability to be able to lock or remotely wipe your watch in case it were lost or stolen. So that would be nice, considering we don't currently have the activation lock features. Another thing that I think I talked about on the MacCast that I thought it should have from day one is something that Apple apparently is calling iPhone Smart Leashing. This would be able to let your Apple Watch notify you if it's been moved away from your iPhone or the iPhone that it's paired with. Basically, if it got out of wireless Bluetooth range, that way you wouldn't accidentally leave your phone behind. I would imagine that the feature would either give you an audible ping or probably more likely give you a little tap on the wrist using the Taptic Engine, and then you could go back and make sure that you didn't lose your iPhone. So I think that would be really helpful, especially for those of us who have the larger iPhone 6 Plus, which I can't leave in my pocket as much anymore. So I'm constantly worried about leaving it behind. So that would be a great addition to the Apple Watch software. The Find My Watch and Smart Leashing features actually may require updated wireless chips, though, according to some of the reports. So it might not be something that simply comes as part of a software upgrade. We may actually have to wait for the next generation of the Apple Watch. I'm hoping that part of the rumor is not true and that we can get it in a future software update, but only time will tell on that. Another thing that Apple apparently hopes to do is add more sensors and health features. We're hearing about the potential of adding a blood pressure monitor at some point, along with sleep tracking features. Again, I would assume that would be tied into new hardware and not simply a software update. And we also are hearing about the new Apple Watch SDK. That's expected to be unveiled at WWDC, and a big part of that is expected to be announced would be the ability for developers to build native Apple Watch apps. As a matter of fact, Jeff Williams told Walt Mossberg that third-party apps will be able to get direct access to all of the Apple Watch sensors, and that fully native Apple Watch apps should start appearing in the fall. So that makes sense in terms of timing, because if Apple announces the SDK and makes it available to developers in June, they're going to need some time to build out and put those Apple Watch apps together. And of course, after WWDC, we'll have a lot more details about what kinds of features and what kinds of things developers are going to have access to in terms of building native Apple Watch apps. But one thing that has been hinted at is the ability to open up the complications on the watch for third-party information and data. Right now, you have complications for things like your calendar, world time and the clock and things like that, all tied into Apple's native applications. This would give the ability for, say, an application like Twitter to be able to potentially maybe display your unread, you know, most recent Twitter notifications in a complication, or if it was one of the larger complications, maybe even be able to show you a most recent tweet right there within the complication itself. So you can imagine there's all kinds of potential ideas that third-party developers might be able to bring into watch complications that could be very useful. And it would further go, I think, to personalize the Apple Watch dependent upon how you want to go about your day and what kinds of information you may or may not want to see on your wrist. So I was particularly excited to hear that complications might be opening up. Another thing we may hear a little bit more about at WWDC is an updated Apple TV. We've had a lot of rumors surrounding a next generation Apple TV. It's expected to be announced with new deeper Siri integration and support for third-party applications. As a matter of fact, we're hearing that there will be a new version of Xcode along with something called TV Kit that would enable developers to build third-party apps specifically targeting the Apple TV. The hardware itself is expected to get a little bit of an update with an updated Apple A8 processor or some sort of equivalent variant of that chip. It's also reportedly going to have a lot more onboard storage, more than the 8 gigabytes that's in the current model, although nobody seems to be quoting an exact number yet, and nobody seems to note exactly why Apple will require more storage. I would imagine it is for storing of the applications, though. That seems the most likely reason why you might need more onboard storage. Siri is expected to hit the living room on the new Apple TV and supposedly will be used to help you remotely control the Apple TV, but more specifically, probably for integration with HomeKit-enabled devices so that you can do more of your home automation from within your living room. And it's being said that the current prototype hardware is actually about twice as large as the current Apple TV hardware, but it's expected that that will be slimmed down before final release. So it's sounding like it's going to be a little bit larger in terms of height and width, but thinner than the current generation Apple TV unit. As far as actual software that we've seen on the Apple Watch getting released, we did get Apple Watch Update 1.0.1. Most users are reporting that it has been an improved update to the Apple Watch software, things running a little bit faster, or at least you have the perception of things running a little bit faster. I think Apple's doing some clever things with caching, personally, but things like glances do feel more responsive. In general, I've been very happy with the update. Some people have found that the heart rate monitoring is now not happening every 10 minutes as it did before the update, and immediately we started seeing things online. People were concerned that maybe there was some issues with the heart rate sensor. Since that update came out, Apple has now clarified that the change actually is a feature and not a bug. They say that now the Apple Watch attempts to measure your heart rate every 10 minutes, but will not record the heart rate if you're in motion or your arm is moving. So it's unclear why they made the change, and some people really feel that the old method was working just fine and wasn't causing any drain on battery. Some have speculated that it may have been an update to help improve battery life on the Apple Watch. I'm not really sure. If you are concerned about it, though, while you're working out, you can just start a workout using the activity application on the Apple Watch, and that will force the Apple Watch to read your heart rate every few seconds so that you can get a little bit more data. And really where this was noticed was when people went back into the health application on the iPhone, you can see how often in the heart rate data it actually is reading your heart rate. And if you look before the update, you can see it was every 10 minutes, almost every single time. And then afterwards, it's a little bit more sporadic. So if you notice that change, it's not a bug. Apple is saying that's exactly how it's supposed to be. While many are expecting Apple to have a new Apple TV out soon, a lot of others were expecting part of Apple's big announcement to be a live streaming service. It's now sounding like Apple might need to launch the new hardware without that feature in place. The main holdup seems to be streaming rights for local TV content. This is at least according to Recode. They say that most broadcasters don't own their local stations and have affiliate or franchise deals in place. So actually working out the licensing to get access to local streaming content is extremely difficult. It can take years in some cases to actually come to an agreement. And Apple has reportedly been working on these deals for a while, but they may still need a little bit more time. What's happening is that the deals with the content owners are stalled in some cases. And of course, the sticking point is cash, right? It's all about the money. Right now, it's clear that Apple has had a lot of negotiations, but it's not clear that they've actually been able to close any specific deals. One little bright point, though, in the news related to Apple's attempts to get streaming TV content and put together a service is that CBS CEO Les Moonves told Recode's Kara Swisher that CBS will probably sign a deal with Apple for their network to be included as a launch partner for a new streaming service. He actually said that he met with Eddie Q as part of a, quote, ongoing conversation about an upcoming streaming TV service, so somewhat confirming that Apple is working on some streaming TV deal, even though Apple hasn't formally announced it themselves. But at this point, it does look unlikely that Apple will announce a new streaming TV service at WWDC. Most industry watchers seem to think that it will happen at some point. It's just unclear right now as to when. Apple's next-generation operating systems, iOS 9 and macOS 10.11, should also be a focus of WWDC, and there's a lot of speculation right now as to what we might see in those updates. One thing that might appeal to a number of Apple's customers is the fact that we're hearing both in OS 9 and macOS 10.11 that Apple will focus more on delivering enhancements and stability and performance updates than actually trying to load in a bunch of new features. Now, that's not saying there aren't going to be some exciting new features in there. And as a matter of fact, it seems like 9 to 5 Mac is getting the scoop on a lot of the new goodies. One of them that I am particularly excited about, because you know I'm trying to get into home automation and I've been waiting on HomeKit, is a new application called Home that may possibly be debuted at WWDC, but it's really unclear at this point. Mark Gurman, reporting for 9to5Mac, says that the current Home app is pretty basic, but does include some pretty key features in getting HomeKit integration. The app will do wireless discovering and setup of compatible HomeKit devices. It can create virtual representations of rooms within your home to let you easily organize and connect together HomeKit devices. It will utilize the Apple TV as a hub for connecting your HomeKit devices together and offers a series of screens to help users find new HomeKit devices and compatible applications. The report hints that the HomeKit device delays might actually be due to Apple's release of this Home app, that a lot of the third-party developers are waiting for the app to be ready to go before they actually release their HomeKit devices. That's because HomeKit will rely in part on the Home application to actually securely manage and connect together a home full of compatible accessories and data. So what I found interesting about this report was that Gurman at the front of the report says this could be debuted at WWDC, but then went on to kind of say that the app's really in its early stages, at least the parts of it he's hearing about right now. So at the end of the report, he kind of hedges his bets and says, you know what, this might not be ready for the launch of HomeKit. If it's not, Apple could still launch HomeKit devices, but what will happen is they will just have integration with Siri, and you'll likely have to rely on the separate native third-party applications that would come along with the HomeKit devices. And this is because Apple has actually already confirmed that HomeKit devices will be hitting the shelves in June. So if they don't have the Home software ready, they're going to have to move forward, because one of the big promises of HomeKit was that it was going to be out, and we haven't seen it yet. But another one of the big promises was that HomeKit devices would be integrated. So it's sounding like this Home application is a key part of making that happen. If Apple does have to launch HomeKit without the Home application and without that tight integration, personally, I feel that would be another misstep in the launch of HomeKit, and Apple will need to step up to the plate and kind of get that software out there so that we can have that integrated support. Because the problem with the home automation market right now is exactly this issue of different devices requiring different apps and not being able to talk to each other, all being kind of disconnected. So really, to deliver on the full solution, Apple needs to bring this all together. And it's just not clear at this point if that's going to happen. We'll know, obviously, more after WWDC. Outside of Home and HomeKit, it's being said that iOS 9 will focus more on stability, performance, and finish. There is a handful of new and possibly powerful features being talked about, though. Apple is said to be working on an iOS initiative called Proactive that will be designed to integrate features like Siri, Maps, Contacts, Calendar, Passbook, and third-party applications into an expanded version of Spotlight Search, where the Proactive technology would actually expand the functionality of your search results. So the way it would kind of work is you'd have contextual data that would be attached to your search results, meaning for things like, say, you have a flight coming up and it's listed in your calendar. You also have that boarding pass in your passbook. If you were doing a search of your calendar data, there would be a little bubble that would be provided by a new Proactive screen, and it would appear around your flight time, and then tapping on that would provide you quick access to that boarding pass. Another thing that we're hearing about is that Proactive would be able to learn and display applications based on your usage patterns. So if you happen to always open the same application when you wake up in the morning, the Proactive screen would actually already have that app there and ready to go. So when you went into the Spotlight search screen, you could just simply tap on that application and launch it right from there. You're not going to have to go through your Springboard or your folders and find that one. It's also being said that Proactive will work with third-party applications and that it could provide access to a limited Siri API, something that they're calling Breadcrumbs. There wasn't a lot of details on specifically what that would do, but supposedly it would let Proactive and Siri index your applications, but any other kind of access would be limited due to privacy concerns. So not a full opening up of the Siri API to third-party applications, but there might be something in there, and I'm really hoping we're going to hear a little bit more details about that at WWDC. One other thing that's happening around Spotlight searching is it's sounding like that Apple is planning on moving the Spotlight search back to the left of the home screen. So you would swipe back over to the left, get back to Spotlight searching. Although it sounds like also that they're doing that in addition to leaving it still up at the top. So you would have the option to either swipe down from the main Springboard or swipe over to the left to access your Spotlight search. And I assume by proxy the new Proactive features and functionality. macOS 10.11 is also expected to be more of a stability performance update, which is great news. But one possible new feature that we're hearing about is Control Center making its way into the operating system. It would reportedly slide out from the left of the screen and provide quick access to things like music playback, your volume, your networking controls, Bluetooth, essentially the same things that you would see in iOS, and it would pull them out of the ever-crowded menu bar, that stuff that gets crammed there up in the right-hand side of your menu bar. So that would actually be a welcome addition to the operating system. Another feature that we're hearing about is actually something that would come to both iOS 9 and macOS 10.11, a much lower level feature, actually a kernel level security feature called Rootless. This reportedly would help prevent malware and would increase extension safety along with preserving the security of sensitive data. It's unclear, though, if that would cause further sort of sandboxing of third-party applications and what other ramifications it might have. We're going to probably have to wait till WWDC to find out a little bit more detail about the Rootless functionality. But Apple continually trying to stay on top of security and privacy, which I think is a good thing for all of us. Also to that end, a third feature that we're hearing about is something called Trusted Wi-Fi. Now, this might not make it into the early release of the operating system, but could come later in the year or maybe even next year. Trusted Wi-Fi would allow your Macs and iOS devices to connect to authorized wireless routers without having to enable any additional security measures. But then when you were connecting to non-trusted routers, it would actually instate a more heavily encrypted wireless connection to provide you, I think, a bit better security. So sounds like it's all designed to make connecting to trusted known networks much more easy and protect you when you're sort of outside those environments. And finally, some welcome news for folks who are running older iOS devices. We're hearing that iOS should run much better on older devices, going back as far as maybe those with A5 processors. That's because Apple has supposedly changed how they're actually building out iOS 9. What they're doing now is building a core version of the operating system that runs efficiently on Apple's base level devices, and then enabling additional features to support the higher level devices one by one. This is different than what Apple was doing in the past, which was basically creating a build for the current model devices and then turning off or removing features when in testing they found that it didn't perform very well on older devices. So they kind of flipped things around. And reportedly that means that when Apple lists the minimum specifications this time around, if you have one of those models on the bottom end, it should perform, or the operating system should perform, much better for you right from the get-go. Years ago, when Apple made the transition in iOS from Google Maps being the primary system to their own Apple Maps, one of the key features that was lost was transit directions, and many of us have been waiting for those to come back. As a matter of fact, we had heard last year that they might be coming back in iOS 8, but supposedly because of personnel issues, data inconsistencies, and Apple only being able to get coverage in a few key markets, Apple supposedly pulled the feature at the last minute. Well, now we're hearing that iOS 9 might finally be the year that we get transit directions back. What we're hearing is that there's a new transit view in the operating system alongside the existing standard hybrid and satellite flyover views. It's supposed to enable you to do trip planning for different sorts of transportation, bus, trains, those sorts of things. We're also hearing that there's going to be larger icons for users to be able to more quickly spot airports, subway stations, and train stations. It still, though, seems like the rollout will be slow and maybe even later than expected. Some of the reports say that when it launches, Apple will just have transit directions available in two cities in the U.S., one in Canada, and three across Europe. They will, however, have the ability to roll out to more cities with over-the-air updates, and Boston, Massachusetts, and Tokyo, Japan are supposedly part of that phase two rollout. Another mapping effort that we're hearing about that Apple is continuing to work on is their indoor mapping effort. As a matter of fact, one of the reports I was reading said there's little robots running around Apple's campus mapping things as part of that program. It's unclear how far along they are with that effort, though, and it's also unclear whether or not that will be part of updates to Apple Maps this year. Another thing that's happening with Apple Maps that we've been hearing about over the last couple months is those mysterious Apple vans. These are Dodge Caravan minivans that are driving around with all sorts of sensors on them, FLIR cameras and regular cameras, and they look like funky things if you've seen the pictures. But what's happening is Apple is reportedly working hard on collecting their own mapping data to help reduce their reliance on third-party providers. The current version of Apple Maps actually uses a lot of data from third-party companies, and I guess Apple wants to bring more of that in-house. That's something that Apple really likes to do. They like to have control over all of their technology. We've seen all of these acquisitions over the past year or so, actually past couple years in the mapping space. So all of these reports actually do make a lot of sense. Another thing that I think myself and many other folks are hoping that is happening with these Apple vans is because they have all the camera tech on there, that Apple will eventually bring some sort of street level or street view functionality to complement their flyover system in Apple Maps. So hopefully that will come to fruition at some point. But again, it's unclear when and if that stuff will happen. And I want to talk a little bit about Apple Pay here because I wasn't sure where else to fit it in the show, honestly. Apple Pay is supposedly getting a rewards program, at least according to the New York Times. Apple plans to offer perks to customers who use Apple Pay, and the system could tie in with iAd to actually deliver targeted ads to consumers via iBeacon or low-energy Bluetooth, and that would offer up coupons for free or discounted products, again, if you use Apple Pay. And I don't know, how do you feel about a rewards program with Apple Pay? Is that something you'd want to tap into? Would you exchange or be willing to provide up information to retailers in exchange for discounts and premiums and rewards? I think a lot of people actually would. I just don't know how Apple is going to resolve that with their sort of extreme protection of consumer privacy. You know, part of the whole genesis behind Apple Pay was that it helps protect our consumer identity and our credit cards and things like that. So they're going to have to sort of explain that to us. But with Currency and now the recently announced Google Android Pay coming up, and both of those systems reportedly having some sort of rewards program, it sounds like this is a direction that mobile contactless payments are moving into. And then the last thing that's sort of Apple Pay related and actually good news for Apple is that Target plans to support Apple Pay at their retail stores. Now, Target was part of the Currency merchant customer exchange system, and so this would mean they wouldn't be able to participate in that platform, but I guess they've seen the light, and they had been using Apple Pay just in their online app, but you couldn't use it at retail stores at their terminals. They're saying that the rollout will happen once they've upgraded all of their terminal system to the new, what they're calling chip and pin, or really, just to give Dave Hamilton some credit, in the U.S., what's going to be a chip and sign system. So you'll no longer swipe. You'll have a chip that you'll slide your card into, but you're still going to have to sign unless you're using a contactless payment system like Apple Pay. So Apple Pay at Target retail stores, that's the second sort of big major merchant customer exchange company to fall after Best Buy also announced that they plan to support Apple Pay. And I personally love Apple Pay, so this was really good, happy news for me. And then the last thing in the news for this week is Johnny Ive now has a new title. He received a promotion. He was promoted from Senior Vice President of Design to a new position at Apple that's being called Chief Design Officer. So he is the third person to get a chief title, and this is a brand new one. Prior to this, you just had Tim Cook as the chief executive officer and Luca Misteri as chief financial officer. It's being said that the new role will let Johnny be freed up from a lot of the administrative and management work that he had to do as Apple's senior VP of design, and also will let him travel more to focus more completely on his design efforts, including design in Apple's retail stores and office spaces, as well as product packaging, hardware, and software UI. In addition to Johnny receiving the new title, Apple has also promoted two other senior designers. Richard Howarth, who led the iPhone project, will take over industrial design duties, and Alan Dye, who was responsible for the Apple Watch UI, will become Apple's head of user interface. And both Dye and Howarth will be directly under Johnny Ive, Howarth taking over basically what amounts to the hardware design and Dye being responsible for software and user interface. Another interesting thing to note about Howarth was that he was the lead designer on the Titanium PowerBook G4, the original iPhone, the iPod, and the iPad. So he has a great design history in hardware design, and that Titanium PowerBook G4, I mean, that thing was awesome. You remember that? It got a little bit nostalgic when I read that he had actually designed that. After this announcement came out, there was a lot of speculation that, you know, what does this mean? What's going on? Is Johnny on his way out of Apple? Is this sort of his first step? And what was keyed upon was this idea that this position was going to let Johnny travel more. So the thought for a long time has been that he's had this desire to move back to the UK, and that his responsibilities at Apple were sort of keeping him there. And I guess the theory would be that he'd move to the UK and then just travel to fulfill his various duties within Apple. Since then, both Ive and a lot of people in the media have pointed out that this is crazy. Ive actually is going to have a bigger responsibility at Apple now with this new position, and he's going to have more of an ability to oversee all of the design efforts that are going on in a bunch of different areas. And he has in the past sort of expressed this desire to get beyond just the hardware and software, get into things more like architecture or the designing of these interior spaces. So I think this is really going to make him more passionate and more involved in the design that's going on at Apple. And I think it's really ultimately a good move. So I, you know, depending upon what you've been reading, you may have seen some negative stuff. And I just wanted to give my take and maybe dispel some of those myths that you might be hearing that are being spun by a bunch of people in the tech industry. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors. Actually, welcome a new sponsor to the MacCast, and that is Casper. Personally, I think that going into a mattress store to buy a mattress, for me, ranks right up there with going in to buy a car. It's a very similar experience. You know you're going to walk in, and by the time you leave, you're going to not quite have the mattress that you wanted, and you're going to feel like you overpaid. That's why I'm really excited that Casper came on board, and they're our newest sponsor. They're actually revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and actually passing the savings on to you. So they sent me one to try out, and I have to say it's amazing. The shipping was fast. The unboxing was easy. It's actually a really cool, amazing process because the box shows up. They give you this little cool tool for unpacking it, and you take it out of the box, and it just expands open into this giant thing. I don't know how they magically get all of that into the box, but they do. And so far, sleeping on it has been wonderful. I think it's firm enough for those people who like to sleep on their back and has just enough give and support if you're more of a side sleeper. So with Casper, what you do is you buy direct and you get the benefit of getting an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. You can get a twin size mattress for just $500, and it's just $950 for a king size mattress. And compare that to industry averages, and you know that's an outstanding price point. The Casper mattress is actually one of a kind. They use a new hybrid mattress technology that combines premium latex foam with memory foam. And that gives it just the right amount of sink with just the right amount of bounce, giving you a great sleeping experience for better nights and brighter days. Casper has really turned the buying process into a risk-free experience. They offer free delivery and painless returns, so you can try sleeping on a Casper mattress for 100 days. You get a 100-day trial, and if somehow it doesn't suit you, you can return it. And I actually wondered about that too and exactly how it worked. What they do is they actually arrange to pick up the mattress if you don't want to keep it and donate it to a local charity. So it's really a win-win. You have nothing to lose for trying out Casper. And honestly, you're going to want to keep the mattress. Best part of all, MacCast listeners, you can get $50 toward your mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/MacCast and using the code MacCast, MacCast. I really think you should give Casper a try, and I'm really happy to have them as a sponsor of the MacCast. So check it out, casper.com/MacCast, and remember to use the code MacCast to get $50 toward your mattress purchase. And a big thank you to Casper for their support of the show. I thought about putting this next little bit in the news portion of the show because this is kind of some news about the next beta build of, or in the next version of macOS 10.10, 10.10.4. But it really is also kind of a follow-up to something we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, which was Discovery D, the little networking process that's in macOS 10.10 that's been causing an issue for a lot of people, myself included. And we offer some tips and tricks on how you might manage that. I mean, essentially, if Discovery D has gone south on you and you're having networking and, you know, issues loading websites, all you can do is really reboot your Mac. Well, turns out that Apple has probably recognized that there's a problem with Discovery D2, and it was noticed in the latest beta build of macOS 10.10.4 that Discovery D has actually been replaced by the old tried and true trusted MDNS responder. That's actually the system that did the same function as Discovery D, but back in OS X Mavericks. If you have been hit by the issues, just in case you missed our last episode, there were numerous reports in OS X Yosemite that suddenly the Mac would go to 100% CPU utilization, people were getting battery life drains, Wi-Fi issues, and all of those things were being traced back to Discovery D. It was also being noted that Discovery D could cause problems with slow wake from sleep or failures in resolving DNS names. Also, what I was seeing and what I commented on that last show was duplicate machine names. So suddenly you'd have your Mac on the network and it would have a little parentheses 1 or a parentheses 2 off of the network name. And that's a sign that something has gone south with Discovery D. So it's really not clear why Discovery D was implemented in the first place. A lot of folks thought that maybe it was to add the handoff functionality that was introduced in macOS 10 Yosemite. But now MDNS Responder has suddenly returned in this beta build. So it kind of puts in my mind a question on that. If they could have done it with MDNS Responder, why didn't they do that? Why'd they have to develop a whole new thing? But regardless, I would assume that the version of MDNS Responder that is in the 10.10.4 beta build is not quite the same one that we had in OS X Mavericks. I would imagine it was tweaked for some of the handoff functionality and some of those more advanced networking features that come with OS X Yosemite. But regardless, it's sounding like that issue is being addressed, and hopefully with the next update, we won't have to worry about it anymore. Until then, though, I did want to give you a little bit of a follow-up because I received an email from listener Dan, and he sent me some handy terminal commands that will allow you to basically shut down the Discovery D service using the terminal and then bring it back up so that you don't actually have to go do a full reboot of your operating system. So I will have those terminal commands in the show notes at maccast.com. There's two of them that you run. Basically, one of them unloads the Discovery D service, and then the second one reloads that back into the operating system. And as a matter of fact, I took his terminal commands and actually worked those into a little automator workflow for my own system, so I can actually just have a little application that I double click on and it runs these. You do need to have like root access or sudo access to be able to run the commands, so you're going to have to put in your admin password, and my little automator workflow will actually prompt you for the password and then run these commands for you. So you can check that out. I'll have a link to that workflow also in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to play around with it. And if you want to make it better, by all means, do that. And if you do, just let me know about it and maybe send me a link and we can continue to share that. But hopefully we won't have to do this little procedure for much longer because it's sounding like the next version of the next update for OS X Yosemite should be out fairly soon. Another thing that we've been talking a lot lately about here on the MacCast is the move from iPhoto to Photos that was introduced in the latest OS X Yosemite update. And for most folks, myself included, that transition has gone fairly smoothly. As a matter of fact, I've completely removed iPhoto from my operating system, and I'm solely relying on the Photos application. But I might have questioned that decision when I got this email from Robert this week. He sent me some disturbing screenshots of his images that were migrated from iPhoto to Photos. And when you looked at them side by side, the versions that were in Photos were appearing washed out and sort of just faded, and they did not look great at all. And he even said that when he opened them up in the Photos editor, that they looked that way as well. Now, he tried to fix them by clicking the little auto enhance option, and that turned out to be to make them a little bit better, but they were still pretty far off. And what he discovered was that after applying that enhance option in Photos, if he would click the revert to original option, then the image was restored and came back to its original quality in Photos, and then matched what was in iPhoto. So that was a little bit odd. I didn't really understand what was going on there, and I personally didn't have the same experience with my migration. So I emailed Bob back, and we had a little bit of back and forth. I actually had him try repairing his photo library, which if you want to repair your photo library, what you do is, one, make sure that you have a backup of your current photo library. So go into your home folder, into pictures, and make sure you back up that photo library, photos library file. And if you have multiple photo libraries that you want to do this with, you're going to want to back them all up. But once you have that backup made, then you hold down the command and option keys when you launch the Photos app. And when you do that, you'll be given a little dialogue, asked if you want to repair your photo library, and then you click the repair button. And the reason I told Bob to do this was I thought that, well, maybe something happened in the process and maybe the thumbnails just didn't get updated, or the lower res versions that you use for editing and things didn't get updated, and this process would sort of rebuild those and put that back into place. Unfortunately, that did not work. So now I'm at a complete loss, which is why I'm somewhat turning to you in the community. I'm wondering, has anybody else had the same issue that Bob had? And if you did you have a way to fix it that was maybe a little bit easier than going through and opening up each image, you know, doing an edit to it and then reverting it to the original? Because if you have thousands of photos, as Bob pointed out to me, that's going to take forever. And also, if you happen to know what the cause is or what the common factor is, what I'm wondering now is if the issue might just be with images shot on specific brand cameras or even a specific type of camera. Another thing that I thought about, and I hadn't asked Bob this yet, was if he was shooting his images in RAW versus JPEG. All of my images in my library are JPEGs. I've never done RAW. And one thing about RAW is I know that there are profiles that sort of get applied to them, and Apple is constantly updating and putting out various new updates to RAW camera profiles, and it may be just that the Photos application is not using the appropriate one or using a more generic one for the camera that you were actually using, Bob. So I don't know if that's the case, but regardless, we're going to have to maybe do a little more research on this before we actually have an absolute answer. Another thing that happened this week that I thought about including in the news was the discovery of this text message, actually a single line of Arabic script, that if someone sends it to you in an iMessage or a text message, could actually crash your iOS device and cause it to reboot. So that was kind of the news story, but later on we found out there's actually a fix for this, or a workaround if you get hit by this. Because what happens is if you receive this message, it will appear in notifications and cause the crash to happen. Then you open up your Mac again, or your iOS device again, rather, and you go into the Messages app, and guess what? If that's still the message that's appearing, it can cause your device to crash again. Apple is actually aware of the bug, and they're working on a fix, but they also posted a workaround. So I wanted to cover this because, you know, people think they're funny, and they might send you this message, and now you're in this sort of infinite loop of your iOS device crashing, which is no fun at all. So the potential workaround is to actually use Siri. So after your device reboots, activate Siri and ask her to read your unread messages. And then use Siri to reply to the malicious message. And after you reply, you'll be able to open up Messages again, because it won't be the first message, I guess, that's appearing in Messages. And then once you've done that, inside the Messages app, you can swipe to delete the entire thread, or you can simply tap and hold on the malicious message, tap on the More option, and then just delete that message from your phone, and you can kind of get out of this perpetual loop. But I'm hoping that Apple will quickly push out an update to iOS to actually deal with this thing. It's not a huge issue, but it can be really annoying if you get hit by it. Now, here's a great tip from the folks over at Cult of Mac. They actually found this on a Reddit post, and this is for you Apple Watch owners out there, or if you're getting an Apple Watch, you might want to use this tip when you receive your watch. Apple Watch has a bunch of great-looking analog faces, and if you're like me, you might be a little bit out of practice reading an analog time. It's not that I can't do it, but it does take me a few seconds to figure it out. And another thing that I like to do when I'm using the analog faces is I really like a simplified look. So I'll rotate the digital crown and kind of roll back and get rid of all of the numbers and the extra tick marks and stuff like that. I like that sort of clean, simple analog face look on my Apple Watch. But that can sometimes make it hard to read the time because you don't know exactly where the, you know, where the hour hand is pointing to, things like that. And so this tip from Cult of Mac gives you an easy way to add an analog face, but then also have a quick way to glance at a digital time. And what it takes advantage of is the complications on your watch, because most of these analog faces have the ability to add complications. And one of the complication options is the world time, which is supposed to be so that you can put additional, you know, times for different time zones throughout the globe, but there's nothing to stop you from actually just putting your local time zone in there. And the way that you add a time zone option to the world time is through the clock application on your phone. So you just open up the clock app and then you add in your current location as one of the time options. And then once you've done that, when you go in to edit the complications on your watch by force touching and going to the complications screen, you can select world time and then you just pick your local time. And part of the default of doing world time is it will actually add a little three-letter abbreviation for the city. If you don't want to see that because you know, hey, this is my local city, my local location, you can actually go in and remove that abbreviation or just, you know, set it to a blank space using the Apple Watch app. So on the Apple Watch app, go into the clock and then you'll see the city abbreviations and you can actually go in and edit those. Some people like to put a little Apple logo because you can put the little, you know, Apple symbol in there if you'd like. Just copy and paste it from, say, like a text application. And then you have a little Apple logo next to your digital time if you want to do that. So I thought that was a cool little tip and trick if you're like me and want to use an analog face but can't necessarily always read the time real quickly and you want to get it at a glance. One frustration I've had since getting the Apple Watch is in installing apps. Sometimes it can take a little bit of time, and more frustrating is that sometimes apps are installing themselves even when I don't want them to. I've turned on the option to say don't install apps automatically, yet it seems like every time an app updates and it adds Apple Watch functionality, for some reason, my Apple Watch or the Apple Watch app wants to install that application. The other thing that I've noticed is sometimes when an app update comes out, certain applications will become stuck on the Apple Watch. And this looks very similar to when an application install gets stuck on your iOS device, which is a whole other problem that we've covered on the MacCast in the past, right? You get the little circle that is showing the progress of the installing app, you know, the gray sort of pie chart that appears over your app icon, and it gets stuck at some point, and then it just sits there, and then the app never updates. So I ran across this week a way or a tip for how to actually fix that if this happens to you on your Apple Watch, so I wanted to share that with you. First way is to just simply reboot the watch, and this has worked most of the time for me. If you don't know how to reboot your watch, what you do is you press and hold the digital crown and the side button at the same time, hold them down until you see the white Apple logo or the Apple logo, and then you know it's rebooting and you can let go and the watch should start back up. And then you can go back in, press the digital crown, take a look at your applications and make sure that any of those stuck applications aren't there anymore. If that doesn't work for you, the other way to potentially unstick a stuck app install is to actually use the Apple Watch app on your iPhone. Open the Apple Watch app, then find the app that is stuck in the My Watch tab and tap on it, and then just simply turn off the option for Show on Apple Watch. Give it a second to kind of uninstall the application, and you can make sure by after you've turned it off going on to your Apple Watch and verifying that the icon is not there anymore. And then if you do want to have that app on your watch, go ahead and turn it back on, and then hopefully it'll reinstall itself successfully without stalling, and you should be good to go. And between these two different fixes, this has worked 100% of the time for me, so I think your experience will be similar. Something I'm asked about quite frequently when it comes to Apple products and buying Apple products is AppleCare. And I know we've talked about AppleCare on the show, but I'm often asked, you know, is AppleCare worth the extra money? And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you probably know my answer, which is pretty much yes, almost every time. And the reason I say that is because every time I've had AppleCare and something has happened, I've been very happy that I had it. And the few times that I chose not to go with AppleCare and something happened, it was nothing but a regret. So just based on that alone. But another thing is just the stories that I hear from people who have similar AppleCare experiences to what I have had. And actually, I received one of those stories this week from Wayne.
Hey, Adam, this is Wayne from the Sunflower State of Kansas. Wanted to pass on my experience with my local Apple store. In December of 2010, my wife and I decided to buy a refurbished 27-inch quad-core i7 iMac for our family for Christmas. However, just a week or two in, we noticed the fans would ramp up to full speed, even after just starting up. A trip to the Leawood, Kansas Apple Store Genius Bar resulted in a non-diagnosis. They could not reproduce the issue in store. So we took it home, kept trying, yielded the same results. The fans would ramp up to full speed. About 2 months before the AppleCare expired, we made one more trip to the store with the same result. Our genius recommended getting AppleCare, so we did, before the warranty expired. However, it expired in 2014, which brings us up to last week when the hard drive failed. Since hard drive replacement is a bit more complicated with the iMacs, we took it into the Apple Store for replacement. Of course, we had two super-duper backups and a cloud backup. Fast forward a couple days later, the technician calls and says that he replaced the hard drive, but after his diagnostic test, he noticed the fans were at 100% after replacing the drive and had narrowed it down to a defective logic board. So this brought up some old wounds, and I was initially pretty angry that the issue had not been fixed while under warranty and instead was found while it was in for something else, and of course, completely out of warranty. So I kept my cool and mentioned my previous trips to the store for that very issue. He promised to look it up and asked to call me back after seeing the lengthy history. The technician called back and said the store could fix it, and they would meet me halfway and cover 50% of the cost. That would leave my part would be around about $450. Reluctantly, I told him that we would have to live with the issue since we had just replaced an aging vehicle, so extra funds were low. The next day, I got a call, expecting to hear my iMac's hard drive had been replaced, and to come pick it up. But the technician told me instead that Apple had covered 100% of the logic board replacement. Needless to say, I'm very happy to have our iMac back with a new logic board, and that even though it took 4 years to fix, that everything was made right. Thanks, Adam, for everything you do. Keep up the good work. Love the MacCast.
Hey, thanks, Wayne. I appreciate you sharing that story. And one of the reasons I did want to share this particular AppleCare story is because your machine was out of AppleCare warranty. Now, you had the warranty at some point, and the thing is, and I think this is key in your case, you had documented incidents where you took your machine in. So I wanted to use that as just a way to talk to you about AppleCare and sort of how to deal with Apple when there is a problem. And I know we've brought this up in the past, but you handled it, I would think, perfectly. You went in there, you told them, you know, what was going on with your machine, you had them document it while it was under warranty. And I think that's part of the reason why you had a more positive outcome here at the end. I also think that there were some things that you may have been able to do that would have made it go even better, but overall, just a great job handling the AppleCare sort of thing. And for others, I just wanted to share what I kind of feel is the best way to deal with Apple when you take your machine into the Genius Bar, with or without AppleCare. And I guess the starting point would be, don't be afraid to take your machine in. I've had many people that have had a problem with their Mac, and it's outside of AppleCare warranty, or they didn't buy the AppleCare and they feel like they can't take it in, and or that if they do, Apple's not going to be helpful or do anything for them. Sometimes there's actually known issues, and Apple will have issued a warranty repair extension program. Now, you can find out about these if you listen to the MacCast or if you check on Apple's website, but you never know what's going on internally. So they may be aware of an issue, and they may be willing to fix something that you have wrong, even when it's outside of AppleCare. So always take it in, because the worst case scenario is they're going to tell you what it's going to cost to fix. And in many cases, I found when I've taken stuff that wasn't in warranty in for repair, the costs weren't as bad as I thought they were going to be. So don't make assumptions about what the repair costs might be. Apple actually has some straight up flat repair costs for a lot of issues, and it might be a lot less than you think. The other thing is what to do if you take it in and you're really not happy with the thing that they're telling you or the response that you get. And I would imagine, Wayne, this is something that you went through, right, when you got that call and they said, well, we'll meet you halfway. And that is to, one, always be polite but very persistent in what you expect to happen. If you're not happy with the answer that you're given, clearly but very politely tell the genius what the expected outcome that you want to have is and why. So in your case, Wayne, I would have explained, you know, it's been in several times for this issue. You can look up and you can see the history. It was under warranty at that time. I hear that you're offering me, you know, to meet me halfway on the repair, but really you should have covered that repair then. And I think that you should cover that repair now and simply ask for what you want to receive. And I think you'll be surprised if you do it in a respectful and polite manner. Oftentimes, not always, and I want to stress that, not always, but oftentimes they may be willing to meet your request. In this case, they did it without you having to ask, which I think is even better. But that's great as well. And part of the reason why you don't want to get too upset or push too much is because, you know, the guys at the Genius Bar, they have some authority, but they may not have all the authority to be able to meet the request that you're asking for. You might have to take no for an answer. And this actually happened to me recently, right? Because if you've listened to the MacCast, you know I've had several issues with my MacBook Pro and the logic board and the GPU issue. And this last time I took it in for its third logic board replacement, and I told them flat out that I really felt they should replace the machine, but they were unable to do that. They were willing to put in another logic board, and so I went with that option. But at least I knew what my options were, and at least they had documented and I had expressed, you know, sort of what was going on. And they did assure me that if the issue happened again, then I would be up for replacement. So far, knock on wood, the machine's been running great, so hopefully I won't have to initiate that. But it's now documented. And again, a lot of this is about making sure that all of your issues are getting documented within Apple's system. They do a very good job of keeping track of this stuff, as you can tell by Wayne's story. And so if it happens again, they're going to know about it. Another thing, and I don't advise doing this unless you've really hit a wall, is that you might try, is if it's possible, you might try taking it to a different location. Sometimes different Genius Bars, you know, you get different results from, but I would really use that as a absolute sort of last ditch effort. I think working with your local Apple store, the people that you're familiar with, is probably the best way to go. And then the only other thing that I would really recommend, because this has helped me out a few times too, is the Genius Bar, if they're able to reproduce your issue, you're going to have much better success getting service. And Wayne, unfortunately, you ran into the situation, and we all run into the situation where it's doing something at home. You take it down to the Genius Bar, and nothing's more frustrating than this. I'll tell you that right now. You take it down to the Genius Bar, and they can't reproduce it. And you're just saying, well, it does it at home. I swear to you, take my word for it. Unfortunately, they can't always take your word for it. So what has helped me in the past is if you can take pictures, or better yet, even video of what's happening, you sometimes can have better luck getting service. So Wayne, if you could have taken a video and gotten captured, you know, the audio on the video of the fans ramping up, or even taken video and installed a tool that would show the fan speed and the fan running, then at the very least you can show that to them, and they will often use that as confirmation that there is an issue going on. So that would be my recommendation to the future, but at least this time around it sounds like they took very good care of you, and the end result was that you're happy. And I'll say that for AppleCare, is again, almost every time that I've had AppleCare, my service calls and my issues have resulted in a very positive outcome. I would say 95% of the time. There's probably about 5% of the time where I felt Apple could have or should have done more. But that's more of a rare occurrence. So when you ask, should I get AppleCare? Almost always the answer is, from me at least, yes. And then finally today, I want to talk a little bit about accessibility. And I know we've covered accessibility in the past. You know, this is the features that are built into Mac OS X and iOS that are there to help users with disabilities and impairments better use the technology. And Apple does a great job with accessibility. The thing I'm going to talk to you about today, though, is sometimes it's a little bit too good because you can fall into a trap where you've enabled an accessibility feature and maybe you don't need that feature on and you don't realize how you turned it on or what's going on. This actually happened to Alvin. I received an email from him and he was having issues with his extended keyboard's number pad. What he told me was he uses a lot of keyboard shortcuts and occasionally what would happen to him is the keypad on his extended keyboard would stop working for a little while and then suddenly it would magically start working again. And he was thinking, there's something wrong with my keyboard. I'm going to have to buy a new keyboard. Luckily, before he did that, he made the connection that his use of keyboard shortcuts was actually triggering an accessibility option that was interfering with the functionality of the number pad. And specifically, the one he was running into was a feature called mouse keys. And the shortcut for sort of enabling or toggling on mouse keys by default in OS X is if you press and hold or tap on the option key 5 times in a row, it will enable the mouse keys functionality. And what mouse keys does is it lets you use your number pad to move the cursor around the screen. So if you had an impairment where you had a hard time using a mouse but could use a number pad, this could help you out, right? Great accessibility feature. But in Alvin's case, what was happening was he had this habit of tapping on the option key to activate a shortcut and then never hitting the second key. So you kind of hit option and you're just playing around on the keyboard, casually hitting option. Well, you hit it 5 times in a row without touching any other key and boom, mouse keys is turned on. So you can actually turn the feature off in the system preferences under accessibility under the mouse and trackpad. If you go in there and then click on the options, what you'll see is there's options for and this would be the options under the mouse keys feature. If you tap on options, you'll see there's a little checkbox that says press the option key 5 times to toggle mouse keys on and off. Just make sure that's unchecked. And I'm not entirely sure that any of these are checked on by default, but maybe at some point it got turned on. You just want to make sure that that's off so that you don't run afoul of that. But that got me thinking further. You know, Alvin's issue got me thinking further that this isn't just the only area where you might bump up against an accessibility feature that got accidentally enabled. One that I've seen a lot of people comment to me about is suddenly my Mac is talking to me. It's telling me everything that's on the screen. It's telling me, you know, when I'm on a button or what I'm clicking on and things like that. I don't understand why it's talking to me. And those of you in the know about VoiceOver know that they've somehow enabled VoiceOver. Well, there's a keyboard shortcut. Command F5 will by default turn on the VoiceOver functionality on the Mac. Now, I think the first time that you enable it, it actually brings up a dialogue, so it doesn't just automatically turn it on. But after that, once you've seen that, I think it can sometimes just come on by default. So you may want to, you know, be careful of that and know that Command F5, tapping that again, will simply turn VoiceOver back off. On iOS devices, it's a, you know, like a triple tap sometimes on the home button can cause VoiceOver to come on if you've actually enabled that accessibility feature. So, you know, on iOS, you may want to go in at some point and just review under settings, general accessibility, what those settings are set at. But back on the Mac, another one that can often get people is the zoom functionality. Command-Option-8 will actually turn on screen zooming, and suddenly, you know, your screen is much larger. Everything is big on the screen. I actually had somebody at my user group bring this up. They had accidentally enabled that. You can also accidentally enable the zoom by holding down the control key and scrolling on your mouse wheel or, you know, just scrolling on your trackpad. If you start doing a two-finger scroll with the control key held down, everything's going to zoom in and you may or may not know how to get out of it. Another one that is often triggered by people is something called sticky keys. What sticky keys does is enable you to use modifier keys without actually having to hold them down. So with sticky keys enabled, if you just tap the option key will stay registered, and then the next thing that you tap, say, F8 or something like that, that's going to trigger option F8 to happen without actually having to hold down both keys at the same time. And sticky keys can get enabled if you tap on or press the shift key 5 times in a row without tapping another key. Suddenly, sticky keys is turned on. And when you have sticky keys turned on, when you tap a modifier key, at least in OS X Yosemite, you get a little overlay icon that appears on the screen. So that's how you can possibly know that that got turned on. Now, luckily, on all of these things, most of them, again, are not turned on by default, but you may want to check your various settings through the accessibility control panel. So go into System Preferences, go into Accessibility, and just review all the different sections. And make sure you click on the little Options tabs, too, and look at the little checkboxes and make sure you don't have anything turned on that you may accidentally, inadvertently enable. I've seen these things get enabled, too, when someone just comes home. They drop a bunch of books or something on their desk and somehow it magically hits the right combination of keys and suddenly their Mac is doing weird things. In addition to just the accessibility section, there's also some keyboard shortcuts in the accessibility category. So if you go into Preferences, System Preferences, Keyboard, and click on the Shortcuts tab, look at the accessibility category and see if you don't have anything checked on there. A common one I've seen people get hit by is the invert colors option, which is Command Option Control 8. And when that's turned on, your machine looks like it's suddenly in like an X-ray mode. Everything is totally inverted. So you have black and dark. And I've known people who have thought suddenly that their monitor has gone bad and even gone so far as to go out and purchase a new monitor, thinking that that was the issue when really all that had happened was they inverted their colors on their screen. So you might want to check all of those. Another thing that can be handy is the keyboard shortcut Command Option 5, which is for Show Accessibility Controls. If you've somehow enabled something and you suspect it's accessibility, hit Command Option 5, and it'll bring up a little window and show you what's turned on or off within accessibility, and you can actually enable or disable it right from that little panel. And also, you could, if you want, go into the System Preferences Accessibility and enable the Show Accessibility Status in the menu bar. This will put a little accessibility icon on your menu bar, and when you tap on that, you can see what or if any accessibility options or features are turned on your Mac. So hopefully that will help anybody who runs afoul of accessibility, and for those of you who rely on and use accessibility, I think some of these little tips and tricks will be helpful as well. So with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. There's actually a new version of Text Expander Touch out. So if you haven't updated yet, you'll want to check that out. Also, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find out more information and details on all of Smile Software by going to smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/maccast. That's lynda.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. And this would be your last chance if you want to take advantage of my RadTech giveaway. RadTech sent me a bunch of great stuff to give away on the show. If you head to maccast.com/maccast, you can sign up to be entered. I will announce the winners in a couple weeks, and I'm going to take entries through, let's say, midnight on June 6th. So that gives you about a week to get your name signed up for that giveaway. And even if you miss the giveaway, RadTech has offered all MacCast listeners a discount of 20% on most of their products. Use the code MacCast20 at checkout, and that should get you a discount on their great stuff. RadTech.us is their URL. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. The telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. If you are on Skype and prefer to use that, I also have Skype voicemail. Just use the Skype username, TheMacCast. Call in and you can leave a voicemail message there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you're a Google Plus user, you can find the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/TheMacCast. And then finally, I'd like to say a welcome to anybody who has discovered the MacCast through Spotify. We are now a Spotify show through the Spotify app on iOS. And if you've come to us from there, hopefully you're enjoying the content. And if you'd like to subscribe to the show, we would love to have you do that. You can subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast application on your desired device. And welcome, and it's great to have you as part of our community. But with that, that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.